Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. As you may have been hearing on WIPR and NPR, the first verdict was issued this morning in the trials of the police officers charged in the arrest of Freddie Gray. Judge Barry Williams found Officer Edward Nero, who's been on the force for 3 years, not guilty of any of the four charges against him, misdemeanor charges of second-degree assault and misconduct related to the arrest of Freddie Gray, as well as reckless endangerment and a second count of misconduct stemming from how Gray was loaded into the police van last year. Officer Nero had waived his right to a jury trial, opting instead to let Judge Williams render a verdict. WIPR reporter P. Kenneth Burns has been covering the trial, and Ken joins us on the phone. Kenny, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila.
Tell us how the judge reached these verdicts.
He dissected the part of the timeline, particularly from when the chase was initiated up into the second stop at Mount and Baker Streets in Sandtown, Winchester. And in short, he said that the state did not meet their burden of proof. Nero was not involved. He was involved with the arrest, but he didn't arrest Freddie Gray. That was Officer Miller. Officer Miller testified to that. And he also picked apart the state's theory that when Officer Nero told investigators that we handcuffed him, we arrested him, the judge said that's a habit for a Baltimore police officer to talk as a collective. And the state was alleging that when Nero said we handcuffed him, that he meant Nero and Miller. But the judge said it was Officer Miller that arrested Freddie Gray, and that was corroborated by testimony from Brandon Ross, Freddie's friend and another state witness, that it was another bicycle officer that did the arrest, not Nero.
So as I understand it, the assault charge stemmed from the prosecution's argument that Nero was part of the effort to detain Freddie Gray without justification. So is there anything that we know from Judge Williams' verdict as to how he looks upon the arrest? I mean, you made it clear that he did not hold Officer Nero responsible for the arrest, but
the assault charge came from it's the language that you're going to hear for the next 24 to 48 hours is unwanted touching. That, and for the state, that meant arresting Freddie Gray without probable cause. But as the defense presented during this entire trial, the officers, Officer Nero, Officer Miller, they had justification based on Wardlaw, a Supreme Court decision that said if you're in a high crime area, a known high crime area, and a suspect takes off running from a police officer, that officer has a right to chase after the suspect. But one thing to note, the judge did not get into the legality of the arrest, and that is more than likely going to come out during the trial of Officer Nero, make that Officer Miller, but he just dealt with Nero's role in the entire Freddie Gray case.
Do you happen to recall Officer Miller, Officer Garrett Miller? He is scheduled for trial in July, correct?
Yes, July 27th.
And the reckless endangerment charge, that had to do with how Freddie Gray was placed into the van. And specifically, whether or not the fact that he was not buckled in place?
Yes. In fact, the judge said that there was no evidence that was presented that seatbelt training was provided. And plus, there was a testimony during the trial from Mr. Ralph Jaffe. He's the IT director of the Baltimore Police Department. They have no way of knowing if the general order if any officer, for that matter, even opened the email to look at the new general order. There is also no way to tell that if the general order was read or not during roll call or posted anywhere. Now, just to back up a little bit, the general order I'm referring to was the one posted days before the Freddie Gray incident that required officers to seatbelt detainees that they transport. And it took away the discretion of the officer whether or not it was safe for them to do so. And it should also be noted that the judge said that it was ultimately up to the van driver. So look for how this general order will play into the next trial, which is Officer Caesar Goodson. That's scheduled to begin June the 6th.
And that is, so that is the next trial, the trial of the officer who was driving the van. Doug Colbert, a professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law, has been following this trial pretty closely in the courtroom most days, and he joins us on the line. Doug, welcome to Midday.
Sheila, I'm sorry, but I'm having difficulty hearing. Let me find another location here, and then I'll be happy to share the information with your listeners.
Okay. I've got a few more questions for Kenny, Doug, while you find another location. Ken, what struck you most about Judge Williams' verdicts?
The detail of it. He literally dissected that part of the timeline from the chase up into the second stop, and he took a careful look at Nero. He took a careful look at the general orders that were provided. He didn't really get into the specifics of the law. He just put layman terms around his reasoning. And it should be noted that there was a lot of finite details that had to be fleshed out during this trial. Whether or not an officer is bound by general orders, whether or not officers are bound by general orders, whether an officer could be found guilty by not following general orders. And by the way, Baltimore Police Department issued a statement within the last half hour saying that the internal investigation involving Officer Nero in regards to the Freddie Gray incident is still ongoing. So even though Officer Nero has cleared one hurdle, there's at least one other department investigation and a federal investigation as well.
Right. The statement from the Baltimore police points out Officer Nero's status will remain unchanged. He will remain in an administrative capacity while this investigation continues. The internal investigation is being handled by other police departments. The internal investigation will not be completed until all the criminal cases against the other five officers are completed, because they will likely be witnesses in each case. That from the Baltimore City Police Department. And also, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake issued a statement saying, we once again ask the citizens to be patient and to allow the entire process to come to a conclusion. In the case of any disturbance in the city, we are prepared to respond. We will protect our neighborhoods, our businesses, and the people of our city. That from Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. I think Doug Colbert, professor at the University of Maryland Law School, has reached a better location. Doug, can you hear me better now?
Yes, I do, Sheila. Sorry about that.
No, you don't need to apologize, but I am very curious, as I hear Kenny Burns tell us about the verdicts that Judge Williams issued, what you can tell us about the implication for these other trials, the trials of the other police officers. I mean, for example, as I understand it, Judge Williams in particular, in saying that Officer Nero was not guilty, pointed to testimony by Officer Miller, testimony that was compelled, correct?
Yes, he relied a great deal on Officer Miller's testimony. And, of course, in a criminal case, the proof beyond a reasonable doubt is a heavy burden, and it's particularly a high burden when it concerns a police officer. In the infrequent occurrence when the officer is in the seat of the defendant. So it's not surprising that the prosecution fell short of its burden of proof, but that doesn't take away from the commendable act of bringing these cases to trial, providing transparency so that all of us can learn about the police practices in Freddie Gray's community and compare them with how the police conduct things in the areas where many of us live, just to see the differences and then to see whether this trial can be the vehicle for the necessary reform that will ensure that there are no more Freddie Grays who lose their lives while in police custody and while unrestrained and not protected in the back of a police van. If something good can come out of this trial, then I think it will be the beginning of reform that would allow for uniform practices to be taking place. And that's where I look at this case, Sheila. I really find that the fact that we had a trial makes it one of the 1 or 2% of situations where a police officer will be accountable for what takes place. The fact that the proof fell short of convincing Judge Williams should not take away from commending the state's attorney for having the courage to bring these very unpopular charges.
Kenny Burns, how did Officer Nero react to the judge's verdict?
There was not much reaction in the courtroom, Sheila. In fact, sheriff's deputies, before the judge took the bench, gave their usual disclaimers, make sure your cell phone's off, and they also asked people to remain calm, no emotional outbursts or reactions like gasps and whatnot. From what I could tell, Officer Nero just sat there as the verdict was read.
Doug Colbert, back to you specifically on the question of Officer Miller having very clearly testified in this trial that he was the one who arrested Freddie Gray, that Officer Nero did not. But Officer Miller's words about himself, this testimony was immunized. Those words cannot be used against him. So what are the implications of that when he comes to trial?
So the words and the testimony that Officer Miller provided in the courtroom cannot be used against him. But any prior evidence that Officer Miller indicated could be the basis of the prosecution case against him. But keep in mind, and I think this is very important, that the prosecution preferred trying Officer Goodson next. They felt that they had their strongest case against the van driver, and that's who they wanted to follow Officer Porter. The judge rejected that application, and Officer Nero moved up on the queue of defendants being tried next, even though the case and the evidence was not nearly as strong in the prosecution's opinion as it was against other defendants. So when it comes to Officer Miller, we have three other officers who would be tried first, and I think we're going to learn a lot more about the ride that Freddie Gray experienced that ultimately led to his sustaining the fatal injuries that he did in the back of that van. So with each trial, we begin to reveal, to shed light on practices that, for the most part, have not been revealed in communities which have a very different view, much more favorable view of police. And I think what's important here is that the police officers must follow the rules set forth by the police commissioner's general orders. There was a real disconnect between police experts who were saying that the officer on the street gets the final word in terms of whether you seatbelt someone or not, where the police commissioner has made clear over a 20-year period that every person transported is under a duty of care that requires seatbelting, unless, of course, the officer felt in personal danger. And I don't think anyone's suggesting that Freddie Gray presented a risk of injury to the officer. So what I'd like to see is that there's a lot of learning from a more informed citizenry about what takes place in Winchester Sandown that may not take place in Roland Park.
Well, we certainly have a lot that we're going to be learning from these verdicts and from the future trials, and I'm grateful to you both for starting us on the road of what we're going to learn. Doug Colbert, professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law, thanks.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
And Kenny Burns, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sheila.
We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll turn to a different question. How are retirees in Baltimore making a difference in the classroom and making a difference for themselves at the same time? We look at a program matching older adults to schools across the city. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're thinking of devoting your retirement to catching up on hobbies, traveling, finally getting around to reading some of the greats, the conversation we are about to have may prompt you to add volunteering to your plans. Studies of the participants in the organization we'll be discussing today, the AARP Foundation Baltimore Experience Corps, show that volunteering paid off with a benefit to the brains of the volunteers. We'll hear more about that later. But first, since 1998, the Baltimore Experience Corps has been matching older adults to elementary schools, deploying them with the goal of creating a new generation of readers. Volunteers are in the classroom working with small groups and individual students for 10 to 15 hours each week. For younger kids, the focus is phonics. For older students, it's fluency, vocabulary, and reading comprehension. With me here in Studio A is Bill Romani, branch director of the AARP Foundation Experience Corps in Baltimore. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
And also with us are two volunteers. Sylvia Seymour Crosby is a volunteer at Charles Carroll Barrister and Lockerman Bundy Elementary Schools. She's been with the program for 6 years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Lauren McKenzie volunteers at Samuel Coolidge and Lockerman Bundy Elementary Schools. In September, she will have been with the program for 1 year. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bill Romani, in a nutshell, tell me how Experience Corps works.
In a nutshell, what we're trying to do is use the experience and wisdom of seniors, a group of folks that grew up during the civil rights movement who have a past that's probably involved with service, to provide their wisdom and experience to improve grade level reading in pre-K through third grade students.
I'd like us right off the bat to hear from some fourth and fifth graders at Lockerman Bundy, because I think if we hear how the kids react, we'll have a better sense of how it works.
My name is Anaya Hewitt, and I'm in fourth grade.
My name is Elijah Lester, and I'm in fifth grade.
Well, first we got to sign in and get our snack, and then after that, if it's Monday or Tuesday, we go to tutoring class. But other than that, we do our homework and a word search or something.
I just like reading, and if I got nothing to do, I would just color.
We learned how to answer questions about stories we may not be as in details and stuff like that.
We learned how to read more, like more sentences, questions, a lot of questions, and write sentences.
I think that's nice because if the child don't know how to read, then that person could come and help the kid read.
A fourth grader and a fifth grader at Lockerman Bundy who see a lot of value in what you do, and Lauren and Sylvia are both sort of nodding their heads here. And let me remind listeners, you can be part of this conversation too. Are you the parent of a student who works with an Experience Corps member? What's your reaction? Have you seen a difference in your own child? You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Lauren, tell me what kind of training you had before you actually got into the classroom.
Before I got into the classroom, I was an addictions counselor for about 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have graduated from Coppin State College. I have a degree in mental health, and I also graduated from the Community College of Baltimore. I have an associate degree in human services. I like working with people. I did substitute school teaching back in the early 70s, and then after I went on working as a counselor, and I retired as a counselor, I also went to Mountain Manor, where I work with adolescents and young adults. And then after I retired, I wanted to go back into the work world, so I heard of this program, and I came out to get the training to be a mentor and a teacher to the children.
So it was always part of your, when you looked at ahead to retirement, you always thought you were going to do something like
yes,
this.
Yes, because I didn't want to retire in the beginning, but I said I'm getting close to that age, and then I went on and retired, and I wanted to get back into the work field again.
And you specifically wanted to work with kids?
Well, yeah. Well, no, not really work with kids, but I wanted to get back working with people.
With people.
With people. Kids just happened to come along because, as I said, I was a substitute teacher back mm-hmm. in the 70s.
Right.
And that was for a short period of time. And then it, like, caught back up with me right now. And this is where I'm at. And I'm satisfied with this.
Bill Romani, how do you recruit people for the Experience Corps?
It's a year-round effort. It's a grassroots effort. We use a lot of media. The best mechanism that we have to recruit is the word of mouth of the people that are already in the program. Not only can they convey their experiences so vividly, they also do a pretty good job of identifying the folks that will succeed in the classroom with young children and be able to make, you know, a 10 to 15 hour a week commitment. In addition to that, we have a number of events throughout the year where potential volunteers can come in, see our schools, see our facilities, learn a little bit about the program. We go to farmers markets and senior symposiums. We have ice cream socials and a number of other events throughout the year. We kick a lot of that off the third week of June. It's Join EC Week. We'll be hosting a series of events throughout the city and at our home office on Howard Street to get the word out. And to try to let people know not only the values that they're going to provide for the students, but as you mentioned a little bit earlier, the value that it's going to provide to their own physical, mental, and social health as well.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about that. But first, I want to ask Sylvia, what experience you brought to Experience Corps before you actually signed up?
Okay. I was a manager at Social Services. I held two offices there. I managed two offices in Social Services. And I retired after 38 years of service. And after cleaning my house as often as I could, I decided I needed to do something. And way back when I was in high school, I really wanted to be a teacher. Couldn't afford to go to college. Had to get a job. And then I decided, after speaking with a friend of mine about what can I do, she said, I volunteer with Experience Corps. And she told me a little bit about it. And I said, well, I always wanted to be a teacher. Maybe I can go and find out what I can do. So I called, and Miss Tiffany signed me up after I was tested, because we just don't walk in off the street and start working with children. But I was tested, and I found to be ready.
Tell me about the testing.
Well, you have to be able to read and to comprehend and to be able to share what you know. And I had a week of training with them, and I could pass the test of background test.
The background test.
Yes. You have to have a background check done.
Uh-huh, because you're going to be working with children.
Working with someone's child, yes. And then after I started doing it, I just started falling in love with all these little faces every day. And they get excited when they see you, and I get excited when I see them. And it's just a way of sharing what I know and helping to reinforce what the teacher is actually talking to them about. So I really love the job. And I know that any senior that gets involved with this program, they can't help but want to go more than 2 days a week, because it's required to 10 hours a week. But some of us are there every day just because we like what we do.
That is Sylvia Seymour Crosby here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass. She is a volunteer in the Experience Corps, the AARP Foundation Experience Corps in Baltimore. Also with us is Lauren McKenzie, another volunteer, and Bill Romani, who is the branch director of Experience Corps here in Baltimore. So, Bill, you said third week in June is Joint EC Week, it's Joint Experience Corps Week. That implies to me, if you're doing that sort of at the beginning of the summer, that there's a lot of training that's going to go on before the school year starts.
There is. Our training kicks off with our new volunteers. We have a one-day training session in July. And before they start in the schools on September 1st, there is a week-long series of trainings that talk a little bit about how our program works, but then there's a lot of emphasis on how children develop, how their reading and literacy skills develop, and then how our people can get involved and provide interventions that are working alongside with the school to help make sure that the children are in the best position that they can be to learn how to read, and specifically read at grade level by third grade. Throughout the year, we have monthly in-services as well that give us an opportunity to follow up on some of the main components of the program, but also we were able to provide training that deals to the health and wellness of our volunteers as well, or it also provides an opportunity to do some things that are specific within the school. We have a chance to train our people as well. So it's a year-long training process that does kick off in the summertime and last monthly throughout the school year.
I think our producer Maureen Harvey caught you at work, Sylvia. I'd like to hear this little bit of you working with one of the students.
This is a
flashlight.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we're going to be looking for the FL sound. Okay, let's skip that one. What's this one?
Tissue?
No, it looks like that's a man's foot in a underwater thing that he...
Duck.
What do ducks have?
Feet.
How do they get around?
Flippers?
Yes. So that's an FL sound like this one.
So that was you teaching, that was you, right? You didn't recognize it at first, and then you thought, yeah, that is me. So there you are actually drilling down into the sounds, mm-hmm. the phonics of the situation. Was that all something that you had to learn to do once you volunteered with Experience Corps?
Well, I get the idea because I work with my kids when they were little. Mm-hmm. So it's reinforcing what I've seen the teacher do and what we've learned through the classes that we have at Experience Corps on a weekly and a monthly base, the basics training. So following that, we do know what sounds we can ask the kids about.
Lauren, tell me if you can describe a young person with whom you've developed a particular rapport. I mean, help us understand what these relationships are like, these mentoring relationships.
The mentoring relationship is that you have to establish a good bond with the children and have to gain their trust, wherein they can come back and feel comfortable with you. The children have a lot of things going on in their lives that they want to open up and talk about. And if they can get that trust, they will tell you some of the things that go on in their home, such as they know they can't read, but they don't know why. And I'll tell them, you know, you need glasses. I think you need eyeglasses to help you read. And they say, well, you know, my mother said she was going to get me glasses, but she hasn't got me glasses yet. You know, and that will make them feel better knowing that I know that they have a problem, but something is going on there why the child did not get the glasses. But also with the bond and the trust, there we are bonding with them and mentoring with them so that they can give back and to each other. Being peers, it's a lot of pressure with the children. And if they can learn how to respect each other, that makes a difference in them learning in the classroom because there is less confusion with the child. the child doesn't talk out, the children don't talk out, they learn to respect each other in the classroom the same way they have developed that trust and respect with their mentors.
Sylvia, tell me about a particular kid that you work with.
I have one this year. He's adorable. He doesn't speak.
At all?
No, he wouldn't speak at all to anybody in the classroom. And now he whispers to me. So I am.
And how do you think you got from where he was to where he is now?
He learned to trust me. But I took my cues from his teacher. You know, she says, I know he knows. Ask him specific questions. And I would put the alphabet on the table and said, something says A. And he'd point to the A's. I said, something says K. And he pointed to the C and the K. So I knew he knew.
Uh-huh.
So we began doing that kind of work with him. He whispers his numbers to me. But he's not talking to anybody else. But I did get a friend, one of the other people, to sit with me the other day. And she heard him whispering his letters, his numbers to me. She says, he is talking. So it's like a miracle almost when you sit with children and you deal with them every day and you see them start to bloom.
So, Bill, this sounds like big challenges that your volunteers are, your experienced Corps volunteers are encountering in some situations. And they bring, you know, a wide experience, but not necessarily a teaching experience to this. So how can you get them ready to deal with these different challenges?
Well, I think we provide them the tools that they need to be able to understand how a child develops and how they learn how to read. And you heard earlier in the program the expansive experiences that our two volunteers here today had and brought with them.
Mm-hmm.
And for you to come to our program and be ready to make a commitment to spend 10 to 15 hours a week with the children, you have the most important ingredient. And I think one of the nice things, too, about volunteers, our average age volunteer is 68 years old, the level of patience and understanding is so much higher there. And so, you know, Lauren and Sylvia both talked about the patience and the trust that they have to build up with the child. They bring that to the program. Our folks that don't bring that to the program don't have as much success, in the classroom. So we can prepare them, you know, didactically and with the skills that they need to teach somebody how to read. But the people skills, they have those skills. Our folks do that. And you know, if you brought any of our 300 people in here, they would tell you similar stories about their ability to be able to connect and trust, build trust with the students. And it's the other thing, too, it's a strength of our program. If these folks were going in 1 or 2 hours a week with a specific child, they may build a relationship with that specific child. But our folks are there, you know, fully 3 or 4 days a week. Mm-hmm. So they're building a relationship not only with, you know, the student that Ms. Seymour talked about who didn't speak, but she has a relationship with 20 other children in that classroom that understand that she's going to be there every day. They can rely on her, and they know that she will miss them when they're not in school.
And we have to take a quick break here, but when we get back, I do want to ask you then what kind of aggregate results you see from that. We're going to talk more about the Baltimore Experience Corps. How is this program building a sense of community? Join our conversation. You can email us at midday@wypr.org, or you can call us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Seniors volunteering with the Baltimore Experience Corps are tasked with helping kids read proficiently. They are another tool in a teacher's tool belt, ready to read with small groups or work one-on-one with struggling students. I'm speaking with Bill Romani, who's branch director of the AARP Foundation Experience Corps in Baltimore, as well as volunteers Lauren McKenzie and Sylvia Seymour Crosby. You can be part of this conversation. What benefits do you think students get from having an older person volunteer in their classroom? Did you start volunteering after you retired? Are you looking for a way to give back to your community? All reasons to give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Let's hear from another volunteer at Lockerman Bundy Elementary, Winston Monk, about why he volunteers.
It was my desire to get into Experience Corps because I love working with the students. I've been a teacher previously, and so it was my desire to come back and to give to the community, to encourage students and to see them excel, to see their reading levels go higher. And when we hear the good reports that they are doing well, that's my joy that I get from that. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I heard about it on the radio, and I came and put in my application and shared with them why I felt that I would be a good volunteer for the program. I just didn't want to sit at home, but I wanted to just come out and just to be an encouragement to the students. So it's good when you see them excelling and see them getting good grades. It makes you feel good.
That was Winston Monk, who volunteers at Lockerman Bundy, and as you heard, has been doing it for 10 years. Bill Romani, what kind of impact can Experience Corps point to on the students in the schools where there are Experience Corps volunteers?
I think over the history of the program, we've identified a number of areas where we are very successful. First and foremost, for a child to learn, they have to attend school. And so we know that there's about 20% fewer chronically absent students in Experience Corps elementary schools than in other similar schools in Baltimore City. And the chronically absent students are the ones that are missing 20 or more days a year. We also know between 2005 and 2011, there were almost 7% more students reading at the proficient or advanced level on the old MSA exams as students in non-Experience Corps schools. And most recently, the piece you heard from Mr. Monk, he's at Lockerman Bundy in our after-school program, and we're in a partnership with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra's ORCIDS program. So the children learn wonderful music and performance skills in the second half, but in the first half of the afternoon, they're reading with our folks. And what we've determined is that children that participate for a year in that program make 140% of progress towards grade level. So where you would expect a child to, you know, going through school to progress for 1 year, when they're working with our people, we're accelerating the progress that they have in learning how to read at a very important formative level early on in elementary school.
That is very impressive. And I realize listening to you describe what Winston Monk does, there's both Experience Corps volunteers working during the school day and some who work after school. Explain that to me.
Yeah, so for a child to be able to read successfully, a number of things have to happen. They certainly have to have the supports during the day. They have to start early, pre-K or earlier. And then they have to continue to work on the skills that they learn in school, not only after school, but also during the summertime. And so what Experience Corps in Baltimore has tried to do is expand the success that we've had during the school day so that we can ensure the added success that the children have in the other venues. So the ORCIDS program that we work with is our after-school component that we're trying to expand. And what's nice in the after-school component, we can work with, we can target children, and we can put them together by level, and we can work with the children on their specific needs in groups. And as I said a little bit earlier, the results have been pretty compelling. And we've seen those results over 3 years. So we really think that it's a real value of the program to be able to improve that child's ability to read.
Lauren, tell me about your experience with it. Can you see, you've been at this a year.
Yes.
I'm wondering whether you actually see an improvement in the children you work with in their ability to read.
I do see an improvement. As a matter of fact, last week, the children were reading a story, and the teacher had to go out of the classroom. So after they were finished reading the story, I asked them some questions about the story to prepare them when the teacher came back in to review with them. And one of the things he asked them is, do you know where Brazil is located? And out of maybe 12 students that was reading that story, only one raised his hand. And he said that Brazil is located in South America. And that was one of the questions that I had reviewed with the kids. So the teacher, he was kind of surprised. He said, well, I see Miss McKenzie must have asked you that question. So after it was over, the little boy that answered the question, he came back to me. He said, Mr. Brown said I was the only one that answered the question out of all of us. He said, that's because you had told me. And that made me feel good, and he felt good about himself.
I can imagine in both cases, and that sort of leads me to a point that Bill Romani has referred to, the impact that this that this volunteering has on the volunteers. What this is actually something that there's been research on.
Yeah, there's been extensive research through Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School on the physical and social and mental impact of the program on the volunteers. And we know that there are improvements in all of those things. And I think most compelling and most recently is we know that if you take Experience Corps volunteers and you compare them to very similar folks that are not participating in the program, that there are going to be improvements in memory during the period of time that they're in the program. And that in and of itself is really compelling, and it's a great reason for somebody to participate in the program. But what's even more interesting is not only do we know that the memory improves, but in a subset of those volunteers, there were additional testing was done, specifically imaging of the brain, to an area of the brain, the hippocampus, that controls memory. And they found that, especially in men, that the volume of the hippocampus didn't decrease as it did in controls. It actually increased a little bit.
So typically, in an older adult who's not doing something stimulating like this, that part of the brain will shrink a bit?
Absolutely. It's just a normal decline. And so what participating in the thought is that what participating in Experience Corps does is it not only slows that down, that decline, it actually provides a bit of an increase. So we know that there is an outcome. The volunteers have better memory, but we also know that there's a mechanism and that there's a change in the brain that controls that outcome. And that's really compelling stuff and a really great kind of a great reason for folks to come out and participate in the program.
Sylvia, I've forgotten. How long have you been doing this?
7 years.
Do you think it's keeping you sharper?
Yes, definitely.
Yes, it gives me self-worth. It makes you want to get up in the morning. It motivates you. If you're not just home watching soap operas or looking at TV, reading the newspaper, even though I'm active in my community, you know. But it gives you a sense of self-gratification knowing that you can go out and reach out to these children and the help where you're giving it is much needed.
Yes.
Well, I mean, having met both of you now, it's hard for me to believe that you wouldn't be challenging yourself in some other way if Experience Corps didn't exist. I mean,
Life is a challenge, and you're always being challenged. When you wake up in the morning, you always wake up to new dawnings, new things around you. Even the birds sound different.
it makes for a quicker day too. You know, your days are blowing by, and you know that there's an urgency about your day now because you want a child to reach a point. You want to get them from A to B. You want to get them to Z, really. You want to have to help them read. And it's so powerful when you see a kid, when you first meet them, they don't know an alphabet from a number when you ask them. And before mid-year, they can spell their names. And they know enough to be able to add one and one. And those changes, may not have happened as quickly if I wasn't there, because my classroom this year is 36 kindergartners.
That's a big class.
That's a big class. And my teacher's an excellent teacher, but how do you spread one person around to 36 children?
Bill, you were about to say something.
Yeah, I think that you bring up a good point in that a lot of the folks that participate in Experience Corps do participate and do volunteer and do serve in other activities. And we also recognize that in setting up the trial. So the controls were other people that were very active that came forward that wanted to participate in Experience Corps. The difference is these folks were spending 10 or 15 hours a week in the schools. If you volunteer at your church or if you volunteer, you know, 1 or 2 hours a week, I think you would still be considered active and engaged. But, you know, the 15 hours of this program didn't happen by accident. It was set up so that it would be a high intensity program. The other nice thing is, not only is there a bond that develops between the volunteers and the students, there's a bond that develops between the volunteers that are there together. Yes. And, you know, we talked about the improvement of the social health, and there's a very simple question that you can ask to determine somebody's social health, and that is, if you were in trouble or sick and you needed to depend on somebody or call somebody, how many people could you call? And we see that in participating in the Experience Corps program, that number of people grows because of the relationships that they develop with their teams. We do call it a team because they do a lot of these things together. And that's a really important piece of Experience Corps compared to some of the other service projects and programs that are out there.
So we have just about 2 minutes left. Tell me, give me an example, Sylvia, of that team spirit.
Well, one of my co-workers broke her knee this year, and she was in an accident. And we've all been calling her and giving her the blues because we're really interested in her health and knowing that she's doing okay. And she says, yeah, I'm on a cane and I'm moving around. So, you know, without us, who would have called her? You know, she has two sisters that are seniors too, but she's got seven other
people.
Support
group.
She's got seven of us calling her.
Bill, we've only got half minute or so left. Is Experience Corps at capacity? Could you take more volunteers if more people stepped up?
Our capacity is dependent on the number of volunteers that we get. And so our biggest challenge throughout the year is getting more people to come into the office and to join the program and make a big impact on the children and on themselves as well.
Lauren, I'll give you the last 15 seconds. What would you tell someone who's listen to this and thinking, maybe I should do this, maybe not? What?
Well, I would tell them to please come and join the program. It really makes a difference in your life. It fills that void that you think you don't know where you want to go or what you want to do. But when you come into Experience Corps, that's what you get. Experience, positive experience in working with children.
We have to leave it there. Is there a phone number people can call?
They can call us at 443-278-9400.
443-278-9400. We are flat out of time. I want to thank you all. Bill Romani, Branch Director of the AARP Foundation Experience Corps in Baltimore, as well as volunteers Lauren McKenzie and Sylvia Seymour Crosby.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We'll speak with doctors about how they're coping here in the U.S. with shortages of many life-saving drugs. That's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.